Welcome back to the second episode of this two-part podcast series, in which the experts Professor Martin Kaplan from the UK and Professor Rachel Reckelman from Brazil discuss how to optimize treatment for people living with NETs and future developments in the field. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and supported through an independent educational grant from Ipsen.
Going back then to the blood screening, we do the biomarkers, or and then if you suspect a syndromic patient, if it's pancreatic, you'll send off of their insulin levels or gastrin levels, depending on what it is. And then for the 24-hour urine, you say you do on all your mid-gut patients, yeah, even if they're asymptomatic. So that's quite interesting. And you're probably right, because as you say, there's a proportion of those patients who are asymptomatic but do have 5-HA. So I think it's totally reasonable to do that. And it's a marker, again, not such a great marker of following therapy, but it's helpful. If they're going to theatre as well, if you know that the patient's got a 5-HIA level that's elevated, that has an impact in your use of octreotide and covering carcinoid syndrome.
Yeah, it helps to get access to the drugs. But also I've seen, not, of course, this is rare, but I've seen patients with carcinoid heart disease, elevation of 5-HA without carcinoid symptoms.
Wow.
So, yes. Of course, this is not common, but I've seen it. And then, so I tend toward, in our database, in my center, we have 14% of patients have elevation of 5-HA without any carcinoid symptoms.
So on this question of the biomarkers then, and thinking of carcinoid heart disease, and do you use NT-proBNP as a marker for, we use it and we published on it, but we reduced our amount of echo that we did by following NT-proBNP. Do you use that biomarker?
Yeah, we do. But we do the echocardiogram as well,
once
a year.
Okay. And the other... And do you want to touch very briefly on the other biomarkers, I suppose, related to considering familial conditions, which we should just mention, which I'll hand over to you to mention the familial conditions briefly and the biomarkers you might do to consider that?
Yeah, so about 10% of patients with neuroendocrine tumors have a genetic syndrome. The most common one is a multiple neoplasia type 1, but you can also have von Hippel-Lindau, multiple neoplasia type 2, and others. And for the most common one, the NEN1, we tend to do a whole screening of hormones. That includes hormones that may be secreted by the hypophysis, the pituitary, or even sometimes asymptomatic gastrinomas of the duodenum. So we tend to have these patients managed together with the endocrinologists, because they do a better job than the medical oncologists evaluating all the hormones. And then if the patient has any specific, other specific syndromes, of course, then we do it directly to that type of syndrome. But overall, I would say this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And having endocrinology together, it's so helpful, isn't it?
And that's the importance of the multidisciplinary sort of team approach. I guess in our basic profiles, because it's so easy, we'd run off a parathyroid hormone blood test and calcium, which would give it in all our pancreatic NET patients, just to give an indicator of whether or not they could have NEN1.
Regardless of age, I do that too, but only for the less than 50 years.
It tends to be for the younger patients. Yeah. And you raise a point in terms of what age do patients present to you. What's the average age of presentation in Sao Paulo, Brazil?
You know, Marty, I've seen more and more young patients in the last years. So many patients come, let's say, between 40 and 55. In the past, I used to see more patients around 60, but this has been changing. I see a lot of patients. 40s. Do you have that feeling?
I think that's right. You know, the data shows the highest prevalence, I suppose, in the 50 to 60 year old age. But we are seeing younger patients, and they often have more aggressive disease as well.
They do.
Yeah. So we're seeing that as well. So that it's interesting that we're seeing that across both sides of the Atlantic. And then in terms of, we've covered the sort of the diagnostic aspects of it. I suppose the other is that in workup for surgery, we'll probably do small bowel enterographies for those patients being considered for resection of their primary small bowel tumors. EUS of the pancreas, we don't always do an EUS biopsy prior to surgery if they've got a gallium PET and features compatible. I don't know, do you tend to do EUS on all your patients going to surgery?
We tend to, because once we have the pathology diagnosis, it makes things easier and faster for patients to get, you know, surgery or whatever treatment, because then we have a diagnosis of a cancer.
Yes. So
that's why we do it.
And I suppose my mind is in that set of EUS for the rectal neuroendocrine tumors. I think EUS is very important because that will look for any, often patients have had an incomplete polypectomy and you're left knowing what's what. So you want to do sigmoidoscopy to look, but also EUS is very sensitive at looking at the local lymph nodes and the involvement within the pelvis. We should probably move on a little bit then in terms of, we've talked about, I suppose, the staging with the PET scans and availability of that. Are there any other modalities or in terms of working up then in terms of the management of how you're going to treat the patient? Is there anything else that you do?
No. I
think we've covered that workup. What about then briefly stratifying how you treat patients in the different types of neuroendocrine tumors? What's your plan? How do you work it out?
For patients who have a more indolent disease, I think the more rational strategy would be to start with a somatostatin analog and then move on to lutetium-177 for some patients if I have access to it. But what I tend to do more and more is a management of oligometastatic disease with local regional therapies. So if I can keep the patient on a somatostatin analog and potentially radial ablate or liver embolize the growing lesion, that's what I do. And then I wait a little bit more to change the whole systemic therapy. But then, of course, targeted therapy, and then depends if it's pancreas or small bowel and whatever. Captain is the chemotherapy that we mostly use in patients with that. I tend to reserve that for more aggressive tumors, for pancreatic NETs or lung NETs, and very, very rarely I use it for patients with small bowel NETs, because, you know, these tumors tend to be more chemo refractory. In overall, and for neuroendocrine carcinomas, of course, then platinum-based chemotherapy or FOLFIRINOX, that's what I tend to use.
Similar, I think that whole concept of for the oligometastatic disease is interesting, and I think you're right, actually. So for grade 1, grade 2 neuroendocrine tumor, certainly low grade 2, whether it's small intestinal or pancreatic, we'd probably go for somatostatin analogs first line. The only caveat is if one had rapidly deteriorating patient with weight loss and sort of that cancer type of patient where they're deteriorating, you would go for a more aggressive treatment in that scenario. But usually somatostatin analogs for intestine, but you're right. I think if you've got localized or oligometastatic disease, then doing targeted therapy is a good way forward. I agree. And we've become more aggressive, I think, even with bone metastasis. You know, we never used to operate on patients, but if there was a single bone metastasis, then we're sending surgeons off, send patients to the surgeons in that situation. And then, of course, you've got all those different options of ablation and SBRT and so on, even for bony mets, which I think is quite interesting as well. How early on in the algorithm do you use PRRT versus CAPTEM then for a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor? That's always the big debate. I think it's pretty clear that for intestinal neuroendocrine tumors, there's not really a role for chemotherapy for grade 1, grade 2 neuroendocrine tumors. If you progressed on the somatostatin analogs, you'd go to PRRT. I think everyone would probably say that that's the way to go. There is the question of everolimus. Let's go to that question of everolimus. Do you use everolimus much for small intestinal neuroendocrine tumors?
I do. I don't like it that much, but I do. We see a lot of toxicity.
Yeah.
So it's very common to dose reduce to 5 milligrams per day. And but yeah, we use it because I think that we have the evidence and the drug is approved.
Yes, I try not to use it. I'd much rather use PRRT for intestinal neuroendocrine tumors up front, and then if we're struggling, we might consider everolimus. But going to the pancreatic ones, which is always the big debate, that once they've progressed on their somatostatin analog, how do you decide whether to go for PRRT or CAPTAM?
I tend to decide based on the aggressiveness. So if I see the most metastatic lesions are fastly growing, I go for chemo. Mm-hmm. If the tumor is more on the indolent one, then I go for PRRT. But I confess that using both therapies makes me a little bit nervous on the long run, because patients may develop, you know, myelodysplastic syndrome, and this is something that, you know, we're going to see more and more with the two therapies added. And also I see these hyper progressive tumors with hyper mutation that we still don't know exactly how to treat them.
And so I suppose, yes, we had traditionally, similar to you actually, if it's fast progressive disease, we'll go for CAPTAM. More slowly progressive disease, we would probably go, particularly actually even for now, for NETTA 2 study coming out for the grade 2, grade 3 well differentiated, which is quite interesting. Do you think you'll use more PRRT now in the grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors?
In the NETTA 2, I think, you know, although the patients could have G3 pancreatic NETs, they were very selected, because they probably had a high uptake on the gallium PET and a low uptake on the FDG. So although they were G3, they probably were the more easy, I would say, less aggressive G3s.
That's an interesting point you make. And that's where the FDG PET scan comes in, because that really helps. And if you've got a strong FDG PET scan, you think, well, actually, that's a more aggressive tumor, and probably go for chemotherapy in that situation, perhaps ahead of PRRT. I think that's a very good point that you allude to in terms of the biology. And where do you use the molecular targeted agent everolimus and sunitinib in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors?
I use in third, fourth line after I use PRRT and CAPTAM, which I leave it for later lines. But again, it really depends. If I have a very slow growing tumor after progression on PRRT, I may start with sunitinib or everolimus. And something that, I don't know, I would like to hear from you. I see more toxicity with everolimus among women. They develop more stomatitis. I don't know why. Or maybe it's something that it's common here. But I see this.
Yes, I don't know is the honest answer. I suppose because it's more my oncology colleagues who will be giving everolimus rather than me. It's now that you've said it, I will certainly look out for it and see if it's more common in women. That's an interesting point. There was, and it's an important aspect, is they looked at different ethnicities in the RADIANT studies and showed no difference, for example, between Asian and Caucasian groups, which I thought was actually important that they looked at that and published on that, which is quite interesting. I suppose I see the role for everolimus and sunitinib is in the more in smaller volume disease, slowly progressive small volume disease. I think it's probably where I see it, the role.
I agree.
And then otherwise, I think the data for PRRT is good, CAPTAM. And then the question is, when you're going down the line and you're exhausted, because now it's wonderful for our patients that they can go from one treatment to another. The question is then, what happens after that when they've progressed through PRRT, then, and particularly the pancreatic ones, and then they've progressed through their chemotherapy, certainly CAPTAM. Is that when you go to platinum after that, and or what happens?
No, usually I go for platinum only if the patient has very aggressive disease.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I try to use all the TKIs. So, for example, lenvatinib and now cabozantinib.
Yes.
These drugs are approved in Brazil. They are not on label for NET, so it's not that easy to get.
Mm.
But we can get for some patients. So that's what I try to do. If I can't, then CAPOX or FOLFOX
yes.
is a very good regimen and is really effective.
Yes, we've been using FOLFOX as well, actually, yeah. as well in both intestinal and in some of the pancreatic. And even in lung, there's some data as well. So that's interesting. I think the most exciting area then in that group that seemed to be progressing looks potentially to be the alpha PRRT, the alpha therapy.
Well. It's coming.
Yes. Yeah. Sooner the better. I think it'll be interesting to see what the toxicities are like, which you alluded to, taking a long-term view of alpha PRRT. It's not yet here in the UK. It is in certain parts of Europe and in the States. I don't know. Has it arrived in Brazil yet? Or
yeah. Well, we have the trial. The trial is going to open now in June, and I'll have it in my center. So.
Oh, very good. Is that with actinium or lead?
Yeah, with actinium.
With actinium.
25. Yeah.
Yes. I think it's a very exciting,
very promising
opportunity there. And finally, I suppose advances for the future. Where do you see the advances?
Well, I think radiopharmaceuticals are really promising because they are very gentle therapies considered compared to other agents like everolimus, for example. And they tend to be effective, and it's very good for patients because they take one injection every 2 months. So it really makes them far away from the hospital. The farther, the better. So I think, there's a very promising way with these agents. And there's also the oral somatostatin analog, paltusotine, which is something that we may see because a lot of these patients take this monthly injections for years and years, and this is not very convenient. So having an oral somatostatin would be very much convenient for them.
But it'll be interesting to see if that takes off. The question is, do you want to take a tablet every day or an injection once a month?
I would prefer the tablet for sure.
Very good. And then I'm going to say, what about molecular profiling and the future?
Well, molecular profiling, so far, we tried to do it for neuroendocrine carcinomas for sure, because some of them are hypermutated, have microsatellite instability. They tend to have the molecular profiling similar to the same organ where the carcinoma or the adenocarcinoma would arise. But for the well-differentiated NET, so far, molecular profiling has not been very useful. What I tend to do is at least the immunohistochemistry expression of the MMR enzymes to see if the tumor is deficient or proficient, so I could use immunotherapy, and it track immunohistochemistry. But I have to confess, I've never seen anyone so far that with a fusion, any track fusion. So molecular profiling is not very useful, I would say, for most
people. I think that's right. It's limited for the well-differentiated. Yeah, maybe it's for the differentiated. It's a different case. Yeah. I think we've gone over our time. And I think it's been a great discussion. And it's been lovely to chat with you. And, it's good. And just to see the experiences across the world, but actually not necessarily so different either in the same sort of problems. So I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure.
We'll look forward to meeting at a forthcoming meeting, and also to thank all the audience too for watching and listening.
We hope it was useful. Thank you all.
Yes. On that note, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you both for this lively and provocative discussion. There's a lot of information on treatment and future developments in the field of NETs, which can help to maximize patient outcomes. If you have enjoyed this episode of this podcast series, then don't forget that episode 1 is also available, in which the experts discuss epidemiology, diagnosis and referral strategies for NET, and how regional differences can impact them. In addition, look out for another podcast in which a consultant in gastroenterology and neuroendocrine tumors and a person living with NET discuss decoding decisions, navigating shared decision-making in NET treatment, including self-injection scenarios and benefits. If you enjoyed this and want to find out more about NETs and how to manage people living with NETs, then please look for the other resources from the NET Connect under the account of CORE2AD Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This video podcast is an initiative of CORE2AD and developed by NET Connect, a group of international experts working in the field of neuroendocrine tumors. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts, and they do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organizations or the rest of the NET Connect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the CORE2AD website.